Boker Tov in Toronto, from Toronto, the Toromotion headquarters, and to the world at large. Welcome, everybody. Erev Tov in Israel, where Simi is, who's our Madricha, our Mora, who's leading this wonderful series and introduction to Midrash. Today we're at part five. So with that, we'll let you take it over, Simi. Reuven selling Yosef.
Reuven saves Yosef.
Saves when I wrote out. Yes. Well, yeah. When that was my mistake. I apologize. Right. Of course.
Yes. That's the. Okay. So, everybody, what I want to do, which I didn't, I don't think I laid the groundwork well enough in setting up this class. So I'm going to back up a little bit to make things a little bit clearer here. We've been looking at the Mashal, which is the parable. And looking at the parable, we see things, we see the parable is very, very built. It's very, very clear. It's very, very obvious what's going on in the parable, because it's always a comparison and contrast. And you have the elements of the parable and you match them up, and that works very well. What we're looking at here, and then we spent some time talking about factuality in Midrash. We spent some time talking about how we are to relate to Midrashim that are fantastical. In fact, the next Midrash, as you can tell from the subject from the heading, you know, talking ravens, I think that's an opportunity to actually work our way through something that is what I would call a fantastical Midrash and see how to handle that. But right now we're looking at Reuven saves Yosef, which I think is in style is actually quite rationalist, in the sense that it really is an attempt, not an attempt, it's the midrashic interpretation of an incident in the Torah. And we didn't really, let me just get that up on the screen so that we can look at it together. I didn't, I think, sufficiently lay the groundwork for this. Hang on. Let me do that again. I have to do share screen, and then I have to press the thing, and then I have to share. Okay, so I'm sorry. My apologies, everybody. By the time this course is over, I'll be better at this, maybe. I don't know. But in any event, what we have here is we have a story. We looked at it last week. I just want to go back over some of the verses with you again, because you read through the story and you're familiar with the story. It's a story we've all read a million times. By the way, that's one of the big things that Midrash does for us. It takes stories we've read a million times and it makes us look at them in a new light. And that's an extremely valuable thing. I always say it's sort of like having a very, very intelligent, super intelligent five-year-old read the text with you. In other words, someone who is looking at the text with completely fresh eyes and is noticing things you don't notice because you've read it a million times already. So we're looking actually here where Yosef is on his way. I'm going to highlight the verses here that we're going to be looking at in detail. And I just want to point out that the first time I learned this Midrash, which is quite a long time ago, I went back to the verses after I had read them, and I noticed a number of things that I had not necessarily noticed before. So let's look at these verses again, just very briefly, and then we'll go back to the Midrash. And we'll see why the Midrash sits on these verses so tightly, and then we can understand what's going on here. So Yosef is coming from his father. He's been sent by his father to check out what his brothers are doing. And they saw him from afar. And before he had drawn near to them, they plotted against him to kill him. And each man said to his brother, here is that master of dreams coming. And now, come, let us kill him. And we will throw him into one of the pits, cisterns. And we will say, a wild animal has eaten him. And we will see what will be with his dreams. Okay, what his dreams will be. And here the text interrupts itself. There seems to be a flow going here. And it says, Vayishmar Uven, Vayatzilehu miyadam. And Reuven heard, and he saved him from their hand. Vayomer lo nakenu nafesh. And he said, let us not strike him to kill him. Let us not strike his soul, right? Let's not strike him a mortal blow. And what bothers the Midrash, as we pointed out last time, is this phrase, Vayishmar Reuven. This phrase here, and Reuven heard, seems to imply that Reuven wasn't there the whole time. After all, the brothers are all described as together in the field. They see him from afar and they start plotting to kill him. Where was Reuven? What do you mean Reuven heard? He just noticed, right? What's going on over here? There's another strange thing in this verse, which I want to point out to you, which is Vayatzilehu miyadam, which I'm going to highlight with a different color, and he saved him from their hand. In fact, he didn't save him from their hand, certainly not at this point in the narrative. This is important because, as we will see when we read verse 22, the text tells us why Reuven does what he does. So let's read verse 22. Vayomar alehem Reuven, and Reuven said to them, Al tishpechu dam, do not spill blood. Hashlicho oto el habor hazeh, throw him into this pit, asher bamidbar, that is in the desert. Viyad al tishlechu bo, and do not send a hand out against him. Leman hatzil oto miyadam, lahashivo el aviv. In order to save him from their hands, to return them to his father. Now, this last statement here in verse 22, which says, he tells them, don't kill him, throw him into a pit, right, is necessary because this phrase, in order to save him from their hand, to return him to his father, leman hatzilo tomi adam, lahashivo el aviv, is important because we have to understand why Reuven is using this maneuver to get them to not kill Yosef, right? But if that's the case, if we are told what his motivation is here, then what's the meaning of this, this first Vayatzilehu miyadam, which I just took the color off of? Why are we told and he saved him from their hand when in fact he has done nothing of the sort? That's one, those are two sort of strange things here in the verses. Another thing that is interesting in these verses is what I would call the Vayomer Vayomer problem. Okay? I'm having fun with the colors, Rabbi Kelman. I'm sure you're very proud of me at this point. Vayomer Vayomer problem works in the following way. And he said. Okay. Generally speaking, in biblical, and this is a principle that is quoted by the Midrashic sages elsewhere. It appears in several places that they talk about this. They don't mention it in this particular case, but it is in a statement that they make, which is whenever you have a repetition of, and he said, you have to interpret what's going on. What does that mean? I actually learned this first from the Chama Leibovitz. Was one of the gifts I received from her, and it was a very useful gift, which is the following. Generally speaking, when you have a dialogue between two biblical characters, you get Reuven said, Shimon said, and Reuven said, right? But if you have the same person speaking continuously, right, from one verse to another, with no intervening speech or intervening action, you have to ask what's going on over here. Let me say that again. Let's look at our verse here, verse 21. Vayishmar Reuven, and Reuven heard, Vayatzilehu miyadam, and he saved him from their hand. That's strange enough. But then it says, Vayomer, and he said, Lo nakenu nafesh, let us not strike him a mortal blow. Let us not kill him. Vayomer lehem Reuven, and Reuven said to them, Al tishpechu dam, do not spill blood. Now between that first and he said, and the second and he said, there's no interrupting action, and there's no other speech. Why is it not simply written as a continuous speech? Why is there that interruption of Vayomer, and he said? Is this clear? I hope this is clear. We have to look for some sort of intervening action that is not, or speech that is not stated in the text. That's what the sages of the Midrash would tell us. So what we have here is actually a rather, in this highlighted section of the text, we have a sort of, we have a number of verses where there are subtle violations of expected biblical style. And those subtle violations are like a red alert, red alert, red alert to the Midrashic authors. Okay? So having read that, I'm just going to take a second here and stop the share for just a second. Is that clear? Does everybody get what's going on here? Okay, good. So now let's go back to our text. And now we can look at the Midrash. So this is the question. This is where we started. We started with Rabbi Yossi. Vayishma Reuven vayatzileu, and Reuven heard, and he saved him. Vehechanaya, where was he? Where was he? Rabbi Yossi v'Rabbi Nechemia v'Rabbanan, we have these three different opinions. Rabbi Yossi omer, Rabbi Yossi said, each and every one of them served his father on his day. And that day was Reuven's day. Rabbi Yossi takes the words and Reuven heard completely literally. He says he did not actually hear the words before because he was not physically present. And we notice the problems with that reading, right? It doesn't fit in very well with the rest of the biblical text. Because after all, why would Yaakov send Yosef if Reuven was there? Why would he need to find out what was happening with his sons if every day a different person comes to visit him? Wouldn't Reuven and Yosef have traveled back if they had been together, which means Yosef wouldn't have gotten lost? All of those questions which make Rabbi Yossi's reading problematic to us. Okay, that's what we did last week. And then we looked at Rabbi Nechemiah. Rabbi Nechemiah says something different. Rabbi Nechemiah said, Amar Reuven said, Ani Bechor, I am the eldest. Ben Hasilchon Talui Elabi, and the sin will hang on me. Meaning, as the eldest, if I don't prevent this terrible tragedy from happening, my fault, my sin, my failure. And we understand why Rabbi Nechemiah says what he says, because he doesn't like Rabbi Yossi's reading, and he is offering an alternative that actually fits in with the text better. And I suggested, by the way, that one of the reasons Rabbi Nechemiah's reading works is because in fact, Reuven acts like a big brother here, right? He says the following after the brothers sell Yosef. He says, verse 30, Reuven walks away at some point in this exchange, verse 30. Vayashav l'chav Reuven comes back to his brothers, Vayomal, and he said, Hayeled einenu, where the boy is not here. He goes to look in the pit, and he sees that Yosef is missing, right? And what does he do? He tears his garments, and he comes back to his brothers, and he said, where's the kid? Where's the Yeled? Yeled means little boy. Vani anani ba. And I, where will I go? Where will I come? Meaning he feels responsibility for his brother. And in his responsibility for his brother, he acts. Now, it is very striking, actually, if you think about it. And I think this is an important point. Rabbi Nechemia, first of all, gives us a reading that is sensible, logical. And as I said, the term I hear or I see very often means I understand. Something happens to trigger in Reuven the sense of responsibility, and he understands that he has to take action. He's the eldest. He has authority. He should do what he can do to save his brother. And he will be held liable for it if he doesn't. Here I do want to point out something that I find rather moving in this portrayal. Rabbi Nechemia sees Reuven as protective of his brother or feeling responsible for his brother, despite the fact that the person who has really supplanted him is Yosef. Because Yaakov, Jacob, has been treating Yosef as the elder brother, even though Reuven should really be being treated as the elder brother. So that's the that's sort of interesting. Okay, so let's take a look now at the last opinion. And here is where things get, to my mind, really interesting. The last opinion is that of the Rabbanan. Okay, the Rabbanan lift us out of this story into something else. So what do the Rabbanan say? What do the rabbis say? Rabbanan amre, amar Reuven. Reuven said, Hu mone oti im echai ve'eini matzilo? He counts me with my brothers and I will not save him? Reuven says, I've got to save Yosef. Yosef counts me with my brothers. We'll see what the Midrash means here. Ani hayiti savul shenidachti mikoach oto ma'aseh. I thought that I had been pushed aside from the force of that deed. What's the force of that deed? We'll look at it in a minute. V'hu moneh oti imechai, and he counts me with my brothers. Sheneemal, as it is said, v'achad asar kochavim ishtachavim li, and 11 stars were bowing to me, ve'eini matzilo, and I will not save him. Okay, so let's figure out what's going on here. Let's go here to, if you look after the Midrash, we're going to go back to the Midrash in a minute. In Bereshit Lamed Hey, Genesis 35, we get a description of the death of Rachel in childbirth, right? Death of Rachel in childbirth, she dies after giving birth to Binyamin, or as she is giving birth to Binyamin. And Yaakov travels and buries her in Kever Rachel, which is Kever Rachel near outside Beit Lechem. And then he goes on from there to a place called Migdal Edel. And then we get a rather shocking story here. It goes like this. Vahi bishkon Yisrael ba'aretz ahi, and it was when Israel dwelled in that land. Vayelech Reuven, and Reuven went. Vayishkav et Bilha pilegesh aviv. And he slept with Bilha, the concubine of his father. Vayishma Yisrael, and Yisrael heard. Vayu b'nei Yaakov shnei masav, and the sons of Yaakov were 12. Okay, and then we get a list actually till the end here. This is a list of the children of Yaakov. The 12 sons of Yaakov are listed following. Okay, so. Some, let's go back to our Midrash and figure out what's going on over here. The rabbis say that Reuven is motivated to save his brother out of gratitude. What's the gratitude that he feels to Yosef? That Yosef counts him as a brother. Well, why wouldn't Yosef count him as a brother? Why wouldn't everybody count him as a brother? Okay. The answer that's given is that, as Reuven says, I thought that I had been pushed aside because of the power of that deed. What's the deed he's referring to? Well, the deed he's referring to is what we read below here, verses 22 through 26 of chapter 35. After his mother's death, Reuven sleeps with Bilhah. There are different ways that the commentators read it, the different ways that the Midrash reads it. But it seems to be, I mean, the Midrashic authors say that what happens is after the death of Rachel, Leah expects, everybody expects, that Yaakov will move his main sleeping arrangements, right? It will move into the tent of Leah. As long as Rachel was alive, he lives with Rachel. But after Rachel's death, everyone expects him to move into the house of Leah, into the tent of Leah. Instead, he moves, this is not in the verse. This is not in the verses, this is in the Midrash. Instead, he moves his bed into the tent of Bilhah. Bilhah is his mother's servant. And Reuven, feeling the insult to his mother, according to the way the Midrash reads it, moves his father's bed into his mother's tent, which is an unforgivable impertinence. If we read the verses as written, and there are many who read the verses simply as written, he does an even worse thing. He actually has relations with Bilhah, which is an unforgivable crime, really an unforgivable crime, and he is pushed out of his position as firstborn because of that. Okay, and then and nonetheless, Yaakov still counts him as his son. We see that later when he gives the blessings to the children, and even Reuven gets a blessing, etc. But what we have here is, if we go back to our Midrash, Reuven believes that his brothers are shunning him, or have shunned him, or have sort of, they've written him off because of the sin he committed in sleeping with Bilhah or interfering in his father's marital life. It depends how you read it, but he's done something unforgivable, and that's why he's lost his position. Nonetheless, Yosef counts him as one of the brothers, right? How do we know that Yosef counts him as one of the brothers? We'll go back to the beginning of the story here, when Yosef is having dreams, okay? It's the second dream, actually. It's the second dream, which is here. In his second dream, his first dream is their sheaves of wheat are bowing to his sheaf of wheat. But in the second dream, he says, verse 9, he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers, and he said, I had another dream. And here the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing to me. Now, Yosef is the 12th, right? So that means Reuven is counted as one of his brothers, as one of the stars who is bowing to him. Okay, let's go back to our Midrash. Again, let me just check that we are all on board here. Is this clear, everybody? Are we following? We're good? Okay, I hope we're good. If not, I mean, I can't see all of you, but I'm hopeful that we are good. Okay, so let's go back to our reading here. The rabbis say, how did they read Vayishma Reuven? And Reuven heard. They say that Reuven suddenly has this moment of recognition that he has to save Yosef out of gratitude for Yosef counting him as one of his brothers. How do we know that the brothers don't count him? Let's go back to our verses here. Okay. Look at the Vayomer, Vayomer. And he said. So let's go to verse 21. The brothers are planning to kill Yosef. Reuven maybe has been talking with them about it. Maybe he also has been participating. At one point, Reuven stops and listens. He understands. The penny drops. So he thinks about something. What does it say here in verse 21? And Reuven heard. Well, what did he hear? Look at what it says in verse 20. What did he hear? Any answers? I'm sorry, I can't resist. Any answers here? What did Reuven hear?
Chalomotav.
Here's that master of dreams, that rotten master of dreams who wants to rule over us. All the other brothers hear that, and it stokes their fury at Yosef. How dare he? He wants to take our position in the family. He wants to see us disinherited. He is evil. He wants to rule over us. And what does Reuven say? What does Reuven hear? Dreams. I'm his brother in the dreams. It's not even a conscious avowal of brotherhood. It's an unconscious avowal of brotherhood. He counts me along with the rest of my brothers. I can't let them kill him. Because everybody else has written me off. How does Reuven know that everybody has written him off? So let's go back to the verses. Let's go to our Vayomer Vayomer. Reuven hears dreams, and it sets off an association with Yosef that is positive. The rest of the brothers, it's like, we're going to kill him. He's evil. He's terrible, right? So what does Reuven try to do? He wants to save Yosef. And what does he say in verse 21? Vayomer, lo nakenu nafesh. Let's not strike him a mortal blow. Now, he's the firstborn. What should they all be doing when the big brother says, leave him alone?
They should say something.
They should respond. They should obey. They should listen. They don't even bother to respond. He's waiting for them to say, okay, Reuven, we're backing down. They don't do that. So what does he do? Verse 22, Vayomer alehem Reuven, and Reuven said to them, Al tishpechu dam, don't spill blood. Hashlichu oto el habor hazeh, asher bamidbar, v'yad al tishlechu bo. Don't spill blood, cast him into this pit in the desert, and do not send a hand to him. This is mitigated speech. Mitigated speech is when a person backs down verbally. His first statement in verse 21 is very powerful. Don't touch him, right? Don't strike him. They blow him off, totally blow him off. What does he say in his second speech? Just don't spill his blood. You want to kill him bloodlessly, right? Throw him into the pit, leave him there, he'll die. Don't actually spill his blood. Don't actually touch him. Now, what's his plan? He's planning to save Yosef, as the verse says, L'man hatzilo tomi adam hashivo alaviv, in order to save him from their hands, to return him to his father. But he can't do it openly because they don't pay any attention to Reuven. He's not going to tell them what to do. Because a man who has slept with his father's concubine is not entitled to tell his brothers what to do. Yosef, however, still considers Reuven a brother. And when Reuven recognizes this, what does Reuven do? He feels gratitude and he saves his brother. Beautiful reading, but then the Midrash goes further. Okay, so we're going to do the last section of the Midrash here. And here things get, I think, very interesting. Because we would expect the Midrashic analysis to end here, and it doesn't. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch. Hang on. Let me get a lighter color so you can read it better. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Whatever. Okay, now it's going to, it's done something terrible. Okay. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. No. All right. It's the last few lines. You'll have to figure it out. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, God says to him. Oh, stop. Stop doing things. Stop highlighting. Okay. God says to him, you opened first with the saving of souls, with the saving of lives. Chayecha, by your life, it's a language of oath. I swear by your life. She'en mafrishin arei miklat chila ela bitchumecha. That they will not separate cities of refuge first, except in your borders. Adau dichtiv, that is what is written, et betzer bamidbar. In Deuteronomy, when Moshe is separating the, or choosing the, how the cities of refuge, he chooses the first in Betzer, in the wilderness, in Reuven. If you go check the verse in Deuteronomy 4:43, Deuteronomy 4:43, you will see that it is from the tribe of Reuven. Okay, so this is actually very, very nice, but it's a little weird. What's this doing here? Why does the Midrash connect this to the cities of refuge? By the way, this Midrash appears elsewhere in Deuteronomy, Rabbah, and I believe in a Talmudic source in Menachot, in a Talmudic source also, working from the cities of refuge end back to the Yosef story. Okay, all right. But so what's the connection here? Well, at first, let me just make clear what a city of refuge is. A city of refuge is a place where a person who has accidentally committed manslaughter, okay, killed somebody by accident, can flee to escape, or must flee to stand trial and to escape the redeemer of the blood. Basically, it's part of the judicial system. If a person deliberately kills someone, he appears before the court. If he accidentally kills someone, he has to first flee to a city of refuge, and then from there, he's taken to trial. It's determined whether he is exonerated or he has to go into exile in a city of refuge. The purpose of the city of refuge is to give the accidental murderer a place where the redeemer of the blood, where the avenger of the dead person cannot pursue him. He stays there until the death of the Kohen. That's the function of the city of refuge. Okay, what does the Midrash tell us? Well, Reuven is the first person to save someone in Tanakh, in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible. He's the first person to save someone. And that saving makes him a pioneer, right? And the reward for his pioneering action is that his tribe is singled out to have the first city of refuge designated in its portion. And you could see this as a kind of recognition or commemoration of his action in saving Yosef. You could see it as his deeds will be assigned to his children, that will be their function. But it's certainly framed as a reward. It's framed as a reward in this context, even though we might think, well, a city of accidental murderers, who wants that? But it's definitely a reward for his actions in saving Yosef. I'm going to suggest something that maybe you haven't thought about. I'm going to suggest that there's more going on here than that. So let's ask ourselves what the real connection between cities of refuge and the Yosef story is. Any thoughts? I would like to suggest that Yosef's pit is the first city of refuge in history. Yosef is not absolutely saved by Reuven's actions. What happens to Yosef? He is given a temporary shelter, right, where he is safe from his brothers. That's what Reuven has done. In the absence of the ability to totally protect Yosef as the firstborn, what does Reuven do? He creates a shelter within which Yosef can be temporarily saved from his brother's anger. And then Reuven plans to come back, take him out, and bring him back home and straighten things out that way. So actually, a city of refuge, the pit that Yosef is in, is actually a city of refuge. It's the first miniature prototype, if you will, of a city of refuge. But I think there's more here also. What is the punishment of the accidental murderer, the person who flees to a city of refuge? Well, if he's what's his punishment? If he's found guilty of accidentally killing someone and has to pay a penalty, what is his punishment?
Pay a fine.
Exile. Did you say that? It's exile. He is exiled from his home, and he has to move to the city of refuge until such time.
Fine.
The Kohen dies.
Until the Kohen Gadol dies. So the great, until the high priest dies. That means it's an indeterminate period of exile. Well, what happens to Yosef after he gets into the city? I hear myself. Somebody isn't muted, so please mute yourselves. But what happens to Yosef when he is in the city, in the pit? What happens to him afterwards?
Sold into slavery.
He's sold into
slavery. Sold to the Israelites.
Exile. He is sold into exile. He goes into exile for an indefinite period. He has no idea when his period of exile will end. He has no idea what his fate will be, but he has definitely been exiled from his home toward that end. I would suggest there's something else going on here as well. There's a kind of trial that takes place when Yosef is in the pit. The brothers have to decide what to do with him, right? You could argue there's almost a trial, like the trial of the Beit Din, even before he comes. They definitely have decided that they want to get rid of Yosef. Once he's in the pit, they have to decide what to do with him. And rather than leave him there to die, they don't know Reuven is planning to save him, but rather than leave him there to die, what they are doing is they kind of make a judgment about what to do with him, and that's why they decide to sell him rather than to leave him there. Which leads us to a provocative question. If the pit is a temporary city, it's a city of refuge, it's the first prototype of the city of refuge, Yosef suffers the punishment of the accidental murderer. Is Yosef an accidental murderer?
Well, brothers thought he was, because they thought
from the perspective of the brothers, he appears to be. What could authorize the brothers of Yosef to consider fratricide? I mean, that's a pretty big deal, right? Why is it that the brothers, I mean, we're talking about a 17-year-old boy. They were adults. They weren't children. They knew what they were doing, right? Yosef is one of the youngest children to be born. So they're men in their 20s, right? They're not children. What could authorize them to do what they do? Well, they relate to him.
Lashon hara against his brothers.
They think him as a rodef.
Lashon hara against him.
They treat him almost like a murderer.
A rodef.
Okay, they treat him as someone who is extremely dangerous, who might supplant them, get rid of them. They almost treat him as a murderer. And I would say there is one other small thing here.
Could it be that the presence of only one mother in the dream makes them suspect that he wants their mother out of the picture?
No, I don't think so. I think it's they say what they're worried about. They say, will you rule over us? You think you're going to be our king? They see him as, you know, by the way, family history would seem to affirm that, right? Yishmael is sent away and Yitzchak inherits. Esav loses the Bechorah, loses the blessings and the birthright. Yaakov inherits, right, the spiritual legacy of Abraham. So, I mean, there are precedents for that in family history, but I would say there is a different and more subtle way in which Yosef is like an accidental murderer. Not the murderer part, but the accidental part. Yosef, like the accidental murderer, unleashes a disaster that, and he has no idea how he got there, right? In other words, Yosef apparently has no idea what effect he is having upon his brothers. He tells them about his dreams.
To push join.
I did.
It's what?
Connecting with.
What? I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing. Let me just finish the thought, and then I'll take a few questions before we move on to the next piece. Arguably, like he had, please mute yourselves for just a few more minutes. Arguably, like the accidental murderer, Yosef has unleashed an unintended, terrible consequence by accident, out of negligence, foolishness, failure to really understand what's going on. He tells his brothers about his dreams. He has no idea that they're going to see him as evil. You know, he's foolish, he's young, he's impulsive. He's daddy's favorite, all of those things. And Yaakov also plays a role here. But like the accidental murderer, Yosef must have said to himself, how did it come to this, right? How did I get here? And he has to undergo some sort of growth process to come to a place where he can really recognize how he got there. Okay, I'm going to stop here. We could probably spend a little more time, maybe a lot more time, on this topic. But what I want you to notice and what I want you to think about are a couple of things. First of all, a midrashic story, which is what this is, right? It's an expansion of the biblical narrative by expanding, telling us what Reuven was thinking, why he was thinking it, is essentially commentary on the biblical text, right? You have to do with it what you would do with any commentary, which is unpack it, figure out what it means, see if it explains things in the text, see if it fits with the text, right? You have differences of opinion here. There are three different opinions about what's going on in this story. And in this particular case, the Midrash is also making a connection to another part of Torah, right? And saying, read it going in two directions. Read it bidirectionally. Read it so that you understand why Reuven gets the City of Refuge reward, but read it also to understand the Yosef story. Looking at the pit as a city of refuge opens up the story for us in a way we might not otherwise have seen it. And that is the power of Midrash. You go back to the verses and you start looking at them again and you start asking questions and you start seeing them in a different kind of way. Okay, so if one thing that you take away from this course, this little mini course we have here, is that you start to ask yourselves what the Midrash can tell us in our reading of the text, that would be a good thing to be thinking when you read a Midrashic story, or in this case, three Midrashic stories, two very brief and one longer. Okay, I will take a couple of minutes of questions and then we will move on to our next piece. Okay, Rabbi Kelman, you want to?
Yeah, okay, fine. Okay.
I have a question.
I'm just going to the beginning here. Let me go to the top. Just good. Perhaps it's not related to Midrash. Any significance that Reuven is quoting, speaking to himself?
Text.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. I have a question on the text. The text says two Vayomers, as you point out, but the second Vayomer, you didn't mention the fact that he says Vayomer Aleihem. The first one, he didn't say that. So
No. It's very clear from context. Take a look at that verse again. Hang on. Let me get it back up on the screen. It's very clear from context that he's talking to his brothers. Go back here. That is verse 21, right? Vayishma Reuven, and Reuven heard. Vayatzileu miyadam, and he saved him from their hand. Vayomer, and he said, Lo nakenu nafesh. We will not strike him a mortal blow.
What about to himself saying, what about himself saying, let us not strike him a mortal blow? And then he said to him.
No, because what he says is, we will not strike a blow.
Okay.
He's speaking to them. We can't kill him. That's what he's saying. He's talking to his brothers. He's trying to save them from save him from their hand.
What is Elohim? Why doesn't it appear?
To them, Vayomer Elohim. No. What's being emphasized here? He says, we're not killing him. And what do? They blow him off. So what does he say? Don't spill blood. He says it again.
Let's go on to the next question, if we may, in the interest of time. Okay. David Eisen pointing out that Reuven and Yosef, in a certain sense, are both oldest. Of course, one from Leah, one from Rachel. That could be an affinity there on a certain level as the oldest. I'm adding. Okay. Interesting.
But the Midrash doesn't say that.
Okay. I'm just saying.
One of the nice things about Midrash is it makes us start to think, right? But the Midrash doesn't actually say that. It's important to also figure out what the Midrash is saying.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Why don't we say where Yaakov dreams a night, Bethel is the first city of refuge?
Why is that a city of refuge?
Well, he's running away from Yaakov.
From
Esav. Running away from. I'm just thinking, it's a place where he's saved. He doesn't know how long he's. I'm just putting words into the question. He doesn't know how long he's going to have to be.
Being in that place will not make him safer from his brother. If his brother pursues him to there, the place doesn't protect him. Right. What Reuven does is he puts Yosef in a place where the brothers will not kill him. Yaakov flees for his own life, and he puts himself in a... He's trying to get out of town fast, but it's not going to protect him. If Esav shows up,
Okay, I got you. Okay. Paulette wants to know, why do you even need a midrash for this, that it's an Ir Miklat? The Psukim also, I don't know, that's... do you want to comment on that?
I do want to comment on that. It's easy to see it after the midrash points it out.
Yeah. I think that's a very nice point. Interesting. Another point: the city of refuge is where one flees to, not where one is placed. Okay.
No. Wait. There's two.
I mean, debating. Okay. Yeah.
You flee to the city of refuge in the emergency situation. The baiting takes you out and tries you, and then decides whether to return you to the city of refuge for internal exile. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there are two different things happening there.
The court case in the middle, right, to the side. Okay, and he's just being out of touch on his brothers. Yes, what the impact is. Okay, you want to continue with the next midrash?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Okay, so let's take a look at the next midrash that we're about to look at. This one is a really terrific, interesting, fascinating midrash in my not-so-humble opinion. Okay. We're about to look at a non-story in the middle of a big story and see what the Midrash does with it. We just have time to set it up for next week, so let's look at it together. The chapter we're looking at, I'm sorry, I had a little trouble with Safari, and so it didn't work out quite right here. But in Genesis 8, we have the story of Noach, right? In Genesis, in Parshat Noach, we have the story of Noah going into the Teva, into the ark, with all the animals, being saved from the flood. And in chapter 8, we are told here, at the beginning of the chapter, and the Lord remembered Noah and all of the animals and all the wild animals and the domesticated animals that were with him in the ark. And God passed a wind over the water, and the water started to subside. Okay, and skip down to where you see here, it's highlighted, it's bolded, okay. Vayimi kitz arbaim yom, and at the end of 40 days, right? In other words, Noah has to wait around now for the water really dry up enough for him to leave the ark. And at the end of 40 days of waiting, Noach opened the window of the ark that he had made. And he sent the raven, and the raven went out, going out and coming back in, until the drying of the water on the face of the, upon the earth. Okay, so Noach is waiting for the water to dry up. He opens up the window of the ark and he sends away the raven until the drying of the water. The raven doesn't go, though. What does the raven do? It goes out and comes back in, goes out and comes back in. Okay? Picture the raven sort of fluttering around the opening of the window. And then we get a description of the dove. And the description of the dove is, starts here, Vayishalach et hayonah meito, he sent the dove from with him, lirot hakalu hamayim me'al pnei adama, to see if the water had lightened from on the face of the earth. I'm going to read the rest of it without highlighting it. Ve'lo matzah hayonah manoch l'kaf radla, and the dove did not find rest for the palm of her, her palm is the wrong, sole of her foot. She returned to him to the ark, because there was water all over the face of the land. And he sent his hand out, and he took her. And he brought her to him to the ark. Then he waits 7 more days, sends the dove again. And she comes back with an olive branch and waits another 7 days, sends her out again, and this time she doesn't come back. Okay, so let's take a look now at what the Midrash says. And this is part of a much longer Midrash. I excerpted this piece. And here we are in Breishit Rabbah, Lamed Gimel Hey. Vayishalach et ha'orev, he sent the raven. Hadau dichtiv, that is what is written. Shalach choshech vayachshich. We'll look up that verse in Tehillim in Psalms when we start analyzing this. He sent darkness and it grew dark. Vayetze yatzov vashov, and the raven went out, going out and coming back. Rabbi Yudan b'shem Rabbi Yudan ben Rabbi Simon. Rabbi Yudan says in the name of Rabbi Yudan ben Rabbi Simon. Itchil mishivot tshuvot. The raven began answering him answers. This is our talking raven. Amar lo, the raven starts, says to Noach. He said to him, Mikol behema chaya va'of sheyesh kan, ein ata mishaleach el ali. From all the domesticated animals, wild animals, and birds that are here, you send only me? I'm the one you sent? Amar lo, so Noach says to the raven, what does the world need you for? Lo la'achila ve'lo le'korban. Not for eating and not for sacrificing. Rabbi Berechia b'shem Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana amar, Rabbi Berechia said in the name of Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, amar lo ha'kadosh baruch hu. God says to Noach, Kablo, receive the raven, bring him back in. Because in the future, the world will need this raven. Amar lo ematai. Noach says, when? Amar lo, he said, ad yivoshet hamayim me'al ha'aretz, until the drying of the water from on the land. Atid tzadik echad la'amod u'liyabeshet ha'olam. In the future, a righteous man will rise up and dry up the world. And I will make the raven necessary to him. That is what it says in Kings 1:17-6. And the ravens were bringing him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat at night. Okay.
Eliyahu.
You, Eliyahu. You want fantastical? I brought you fantastical. So what do we have happening here? And I'm going to suggest that if you have time and you feel like doing it, you should read chapter 8 of Bereishit of Genesis, just for context. And you should also read First Kings 1, chapters 16, 17, and 18. If you have time, it's good homework to do. What's going on over here? Well, I'll just set it up for our discussion next time. Noah is waiting for the water to dry, and he sends out a raven. What does the raven do? It flutters around. Rabbi Yudan says the raven speaks to Noah. What does the raven do? The raven says, why are you sending me? I'm the one you're sending. Send somebody else. Don't send me. What does Noah say to the raven? Who needs you? Why shouldn't I send you? What does God say, intervening here? Receive the raven because the world will need the raven later in the Elijah story, in the story of Elijah drying up the water. By the way, for those of you who are interested, and this is not what we're going to be doing with this midrash, you see that word yivoshet? Until the drying of the water, spell it backwards. What does it say?
Tishbi. Eliyahu. Mm-hmm.
It's a nice little thing. But here's the question. So there are a number of questions that we have to ask here. First of all, what's with the talking raven? Why does the Midrash provide this sort of fantastical image of a talking raven? Not only a talking raven, Noah has a whole conversation with the raven. God tells Noah, you have to take the raven back in. Is there any textual basis for this reading? Okay, that's one question that we're going to have to ask ourselves. And if you read chapter 8, you may find one, okay? But also, why are you connecting Noah and Eliyahu just on the basis of ravens, right? Why? That's how you connect two biblical stories, because there's mention of ravens in both of them. That is another question that we're going to have to address. So if you're interested in trying to puzzle this out yourselves, I would suggest you do the following. As I said, read Kings 1, chapter 16, 17, 18. It's a beautiful story anyway. It's worth reading. And chapter 8 of Parshat Bereishit, of Sefer Bereishit. That's Genesis 8, which is the Noah story. And come back prepared to do battle, Bezrat Hashem, next week. Okay.
And that Pasuk in Tehillim also.
Look up the Pasuk in Tehillim. What's that doing there?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we'll meet next week, Bezrat Hashem. Homework will make this more fun for you. So
good. Homework. All right. I don't know if you want to comment on the question that came in just as we transition to the next source, thing, the pit not being a source of refuge because he couldn't have lived in the pit, especially there's snakes and scorpions there.
What does Reuven tend to do?
He wants to come back, but it doesn't serve as an independency. Yeah. Obviously, I think it's obviously not a direct city of refuge. Obviously, the parallelism
is
not, yes. Right. Yeah. Because in a real city of refuge, your teacher has to go there with you to the city of refuge.
Yes, but not only that, this is a prototype of the city of refuge, right? This is what Reuven improvises in a desperate situation, right? Right. It's very different from the organized, legally sanctioned, halachically defined city of refuge, right? It's a prototype, the first.
Just like you'd say Yehuda and Yibum is a prototype. You have a lot of things like that where the Torah presents it not exactly as the halacha developed it, but as a model that gets developed.
Right. Okay. So everybody have a great rest of your week.
Okay.
And Bezrat Hashem, we'll see you
next week. Is Achron Chaviv, right? The last of the series? We can talk that, but yeah, that was the plan. That's the initial plan.
All right, we'll finish this midrash about the raven next week, Bezrat Hashem. Okay.
All right, 15-minute break for a cup of coffee and Dr. Benny Gesundheit on Sefer Tehillim.
Bye.
And everybody, welcome to stay on board the same Zoom Torah in Motion channel, or take a break, and we'll start with part 11 of the series. Each one is sort of independent of another, but part of the ongoing series on Sefer Tehillim. That begins at 12:15. And tomorrow, Ilana Sover Eltsufun will be giving the beginning of her first two talks on Tefillin. Her and Lori Novak on the series on Men, Women, and Ritual, the textual analysis. So tomorrow we'll pick up on Tefillin after 2 weeks on Tzitzit. And then tomorrow night, Moshe Sokolov on the Haftarah of the week. And Thursday, Bram Weinberg, Rabbi Bram Weinberg from Silver Spring, Maryland, on the Parsha of the week. Okay, we look forward to learning with you and your friends, and we'll see you in about 14 minutes or so. Everybody be well.